Hi everyone, Gary Monterosa here, welcoming you to this week's episode of Beverage Chronicles. My co-host Michelle Lamb will be along a little bit later. Beverage Chronicles is the show where we dive into the craft, culture, and people shaping what we drink today. Now, when most people hear the word sake, they picture a tiny cup of warm rice wine served at a sushi bar. But there's a whole lot more to this ancient Japanese beverage, and increasingly, the story of sake is being written right here in the United States. Over the past few years, a new wave of American sake brewers has been reimagining an age-old tradition. They're blending time-honored Japanese brewing methods with local ingredients and creativity. From the rice fields of California to small batch breweries in Brooklyn and beyond. This week I'm at the Philadelphia Wine Festival, and on this episode I was joined by someone who's at the heart of the American sake movement. This is a sake brewer, who's helping to shape the future of this centuries-old craft on American soil. And we're going to talk about what sets American sake apart, the challenges of brewing it stateside, and how it's finding an audience among curious drinkers everywhere. So raise your cup or your tasting glass and join us as we explore the rise of the American sake industry. And here's my interview.
A beverage that I fell in love with, I guess 20, 25 years ago, is sake. And I was invited to attend in New York City the World Sake Summit. And I got to sample many, many sakes, primarily from Japan, a few from America, although there weren't that many in America at that time. But also, there was a home brew sake contest going on. So I got to try them to measure homebrew versus some of the professional ones. So bottom line is, since then, again, I'm going back 20, 25 years, I've always had a bottle of sake in my house. Now, I'm privileged right now to introduce to you a sake maker, a sake brewer. We should call you a brewer. And you are?
My name's Jay Cooper.
Now, Jay, talk about your company.
Yeah, so I own and operate Sangokura Sake Brewery, which is in the Poconos, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I'm glad you mentioned that, because we have listeners from all over the world.
Yeah,
they're
right?
Going to say,
yeah, sure.
They don't always know the Poconos. Although most people know the Poconos.
Yeah,
think,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Right. Used to be the honeymoon capital, right? And now it's in the 70s, right? Yeah. There's like...
I'm too young to remember that.
Oh, yeah. You know? Nice.
What is there, for someone who has never tried sake...
Yeah.
What advice? Now, you're an educator. You're going out and educating people on sake. Not everyone is aware of what this beverage is. What is sake?
Yeah, yeah. You know, and as far as like an educator, you know, I didn't plan to be an educator. I was just a guy who fell in love with Japanese culture and went to language school. And then I ended up coming home and, just pursuing culinary arts and homebrewing sake. And then now I do it professionally. So, yeah.
So if I don't know about sake, someone doesn't know about sake, what would you tell them? They say, well, they come up to you and say, is it like wine? Is it like whiskey? What is it?
Sure. So it's definitely not a distilled product. So like vodka, whiskey, you'd run that through a still. Wine, by definition, is fermented fruit. Any dictionary will tell you that. There's no fruit in sake. It is all grain. So... are we a beer brewery? Are we a winery? Are we a distillery? There's a lot of misconceptions with sake. However, we are in our own little niche. It's open fermentation, like a fruit wine would be made. There's no still involved, so we would be pretty far away from distillery. Mm-hmm. But closest thing, we are a brewery. We are a sake brewery because we are all grain. We use heat to steam our rice, and there's no fruit involved. So,
how critical is the rice? I mean, there are different strains of rice. Does a lot of it have to do with the polishing, if you will, of the rice?
Yeah, sure. Of course, it's all a factor. Mm-hmm. You know, it all will have an effect on your end product. But what I use is strains of rice that are originally from Japan. that are imported and then grown in Arkansas and Sacramento, California. At these rice farms, they do have their own specific sake rice mill, which is a very delicate way of gently polishing the outside of the grain off. So we make at our brewery what's considered a Junmai Ginjo class of sake, which means, the basic term means, that we've taken 40% of the outside kernel off of that rice, and there's 60% less. Now, the highest quality sake you could make is called a Junmai Daiginjo, and that's 50% of the kernel or more. And as a brewer and doing R&D, I experimented with those higher higher polishing rates. However, I did find at the end of the day that I just felt bad for that little kernel of rice. And honestly, there was not that much of a difference. Now, in Japan, there's a lot of competitions and this and that. And they, you know, some get down to 20%.
Wow.
You know, and that's like a competition sake. And that's really just kind of, I think of more of like an ego stroke of breweries just trying to do something different and let their brewers do something different. But there's really not much
room.
As
you polish the rice, does it get sweeter as you polish it down? How does it change?
So, it becomes a smoother experience.
Okay.
So that outside protein, you know, that will make a coarse, kind of rough. It'll give you maybe some diacetyl flavors, some rubbing alcohol flavors. You know, I get explained to at a lot of trade shows, people come up and say, I don't like sake because I got it squirted in my mouth at a hibachi place. You know, that's cooking sake. That's not really meant for consumption. It burns. It doesn't have any enzymatic flavors. So when you take that outside kernel off and then really let those starches just ferment in your mash, now you start to get a smooth sake. And the longer you ferment for a slow and low ferment, you're going to get all those enzymes working in the biology of the yeast. And those are going to give you flavors and notes of all sorts of rainbows. But sake is delicate. It's light. It pairs with a lot of food, unlike wine and beer.
And it's sulfite-free.
That's correct. Traditionally, sake is heat pasteurizes, and that's how we do it at our brewery as well.
Have you gotten any feedback from Japanese sake brewers?
Yes, I actually just came back from a sake brewing school in Niigata called Gakugura, which means sake school. And part of that class was actually at the Niigata University, their sakeology department. So everything down to sake scientists to just expert tasters and Toji brewmasters, I got a lot of different feedback. And the feedback was positive. Which made me really happy because I've been brewing for a long time and wasn't sure exactly where I was at in the industry. But it seems that I'm making a very floral and tasty Junmai Ginjo sake. But what really sets my sakes apart in Japan is that I'm able to infuse sake. So we make a bourbon barrel sake. We make a dry hop sake. And so these are against the purity laws in Japan, and brewers are just simply not able to make them, and they absolutely love getting these sakes and trying them, and you can kind of almost see a little tear in their eye being like, you know, they wish they could make things like this, but it's law, and it's also because of the decline of sake drinking in Japan. Things are getting tightened up. Budgets are you know, not there to try new things. And so here in America, I'm able to make any type of sake I want and try. And we even make a apple cider infused sake. And so that's my job. It's just to bring craft sake to the United States and let people try it. And maybe they'll find something new and cool.
Jay, I think it is so cool and so great that you're able to put an American slant to a beverage that has such an amazing history, even in terms of sake cocktails.
Yeah, well, if I wasn't able to do that, I would just be emulating something that I'm not. I'm not from Japan. I do have a love for all things Japanese, especially culinary. And it's important for me as working at that point, having I have an izakaya at my brewery and I make ramen noodles from flour. I make sake from rice. And if all of those things, I become an ambassador of recipe and culture. So I better do those things try to do them better than Japanese chefs and Japanese brewmasters in Japan. That's my goal.
Okay, let's give that company again. Your company is?
Sure, Sango Kura.
Okay, and yep. We can find you online?
You can find me online, yep, Sango Kura Sake Brewery. I'm the first and only in Pennsylvania.
Beautiful. Jay, thank you so much explaining sake to my audience.
Yeah, man.
All right.
We'll talk to you soon.
Good.
Thanks.
Hi, everyone. This is Michelle Lam, your co-host of Beverage Chronicles. And today, we're going to talk about why public relations is so important for both hospitality groups and beverage brands. Whether you're running a restaurant, launching a new spirit, or growing a food and beverage portfolio, public relations isn't just support. It's strategy, visibility, and long-term brand value. Now, let's dive in. PR shapes your identity through storytelling. Your story is your strength. PR helps the public understand your concept, your chef's journey, and what makes your space different. Example, well, a Cantonese inspired restaurant gains traction after media highlight the chef's culinary heritage and authentic culinary influences. Takeaways, a strong story differentiates you in a crowded market. Emotional connection builds loyalty. Narrative clarity increases brand value.
Light lagers are among the most favorite types of beers available today. From Budweiser and Coors to Busch and even Pabst, nearly every major beer brand features a light lager in its offerings. There was even a whole brand rivalry in this category, with contenders battling it out to claim the title of America's number one light beer by the end of the 20th century. Yet, in the vast array of light beers on the market today, one continues to shine, not for its amazing flavor or its popularity, but for its unique spelling, and that beer is none other than Miller Lite. Miller Brewing Company, based in Milwaukee, introduced Miller Lite in 1975 and is often credited with bringing light beer to the United States. Miller has even embraced this narrative in the past, promoting Miller Lite as the original light beer. However, despite the current popularity of this low-alcohol Pilsner, when it first launched, Miller Lite was seen as somewhat of a joke product. For many years leading up to the launch of Miller Lite, the term light beer was only used to refer to beers that were lighter in color or less heavy. It wasn't a term that described the actual beer's contents. Many people initially laughed at the new release. How could something be lighter than the lightest beer they knew and still taste good? Well, that's where the choice to spell it L-I-T-E comes into play. While Miller Lite is frequently recognized as the first light beer, that honor actually belongs to Gablinger's Diet Beer, a lower carb and lower calorie brew created in 1967 by an employee at Germany's Rheingold Brewing Company. Even though light beers were fairly popular in Germany, where they had been brewing this style since the 1930s, Gablinger's ultimately failed. After its defeat, the recipe found a new home with friends at Chicago's Meisterbrau Brewing, who kept tweaking it until they reformulated it and released it as Meisterbrau Light. That's also spelled L-I-T-E. This beer was aimed mainly at those watching their diets, boasting that it was a full-strength premium beer with one-third fewer calories than the regular version. However, Meisterbrau Brewing was facing financial issues, and while Miller Brewing didn't want to buy the entire business, they were keen on snagging the recipe for Meisterbrau Light. So when the brewery went bankrupt in 1972, Miller came in and bought the rights to three of Meisterbrau's brews, Light included. After 3 years of reworking the recipe, Miller Brewing rolled out Miller Lite across the country in January 1975. Despite some initial doubts, Miller managed to flip the script, quickly turning Miller Lite into a massive success. And that L-I-T-E spelling played a crucial role in their journey. Additionally, Miller marketed Miller Lite as a beer for men, which was a bit different from what other light beers were doing back then. Athletes were prominently featured in many of the Miller Lite ads, with almost all of them aimed at working-class guys. As more light beers started appearing on store shelves, Miller Lite distinguished itself with its unique light spelling, which they kept protected by by trademark. And even today, Molson Coors, which fully took over Miller Brewing Company in 2016, is the sole owner of the light trademark, meaning they are the only beer company legally allowed to use that specific spelling. And that's it for Beverage Chronicles. See you next week.